Welcome to a Mechon Adar podcast. My name is Ellie Confer, and today we're going to be looking at the poem Lecha Dodi. In this class, we're going to first look at the history and the structure of Lecha Dodi, and then we're going to look at the specific meaning of the refrain, Lecha Dodi Likrat Kala, Penei Shabbat Nekabala. And finally, we're going to look at a number of the terms in some of the stanzas of the poem. Lecha Dodi is part of the liturgy that the Kabbalists living in 16th century Tzfat in northern Israel developed as a way of embellishing the welcoming of Shabbat. But prior to the 16th century, there were some rituals that were recorded already in the Talmud that indicate how certain rabbis would welcome Shabbat personified. If you look at your source sheet, text number one, we see two practices written here. Rabbi Chanina would wrap himself in a cloak on Erev Shabbat and say, Bo v'neitze likrat Shabbat amalka. Come, let's go out and greet Shabbat the queen. Rabbi Yanai would wear new clothes on Erev Shabbat and say, Bo'i kala, bo'i kala. Come, bride, come, bride. Now, that practice of reciting Bo'i Kala, Bo'i Kala finds its way into the end of our poem, Lecha Dodi. But the Kabbalists took these practices that were recorded in the Talmud and expanded upon them greatly. Some Kabbalists introduced the idea of reciting Psalms as a way of welcoming Shabbat. And some Kabbalists recited the poem Lecha Dodi with other Psalms. And ultimately, these two practices were united into one that became our service called Kabbalat Shabbat. Lecha Dodi itself is a poem that was written by Shlomo Halevi Alkabetz. And we know this because his name is signed into the refrain, Shlomo Halevi. Interesting to note that this poem was not the only poem circulating that used the refrain Lecha Dodi Likrat Kala, Penei Shabbat Nekabala, translated in our source sheet as, Come or go, my beloved, to greet the bride. Let us welcome the presence of Shabbat. Poems that used this refrain and also the refrain Bo'i Kala, Bo'i Kala were circulating, and we know of at least two other poems in late 16th century Tzfat that were used to welcome the bride Shabbat. Our focus is going to be on this poem written by Shlomo Halevi Alkabetz. The poem was first published in a Sidur in 1584, but traces to earlier decades. It's not exactly clear when it was first written, and there's some controversy about which poem using the refrain Lecha Dodi was the first one to exist. It's most likely that Shlomo Halevi's version was building off of earlier versions of the poem that used the same refrain and ended the same way. In that first printing of Lecha Dodi, you can see in source 3, it already is associated with a melody. V'acharkach omrim zeh piyut na'eh mishubach. Afterward, say this beautiful and praiseworthy poem, constructed and formulated by the divine scholar Shlomo Halevi ibn Alkabetz in the city of Tzfat, may it be rebuilt speedily and in our days. And then it notes, the Sidur notes, Lachan shuvi nafshi limnuchaychi. Use this or sing this to the tune of Return My Soul to Your Resting Place, a quote from Psalm 116. So already by 1584, Lecha Dodi was known to be sung to other existing melodies. One other note about the history of Lecha Dodi. It did not universally appear in Sidurim immediately in the 16th century, and indeed was first in Sfardi Sidurim, which makes sense, given the tradition of the Kabbalists was most directly related to the Sfardim. However, it didn't appear in an Ashkenazi Sidur until 1667, probably 100 years after it was written. And there were a number of controversies in the years following about whether to sing Lecha Dodi, how much of the Charedi to sing, and whether certain lines shouldn't be said on Shabbat because they were too sad, and mentioned, for instance, Jerusalem sitting in the Valley of Tears. But ultimately, the Charedi was accepted in all traditions and all rites, and is recited today in pretty much every synagogue service. We're going to look at the structure of the poem and then move to the refrain and the specific stanzas. Noting the structure, we already said that it's built around the name Shlomo Halevi. The problem, however, is that Shlomo Halevi is 8 letters, and there are 9 stanzas. The last stanza, Bo'ivi Shalom, begins with the letter Bet, and actually has nothing to do with Shlomo Halevi's name. So why are there 9 stanzas instead of 8, which would more conform to the poet's name? In order to answer the structural question, we have to note that this was written by a Kabbalist, and therefore the structure of the poem itself reflects Kabbalistic approaches and theology. We're going to delve into those even more deeply when we look at the specific words of the stanza and the refrain, but even in the structure, it's important to note Kabbalistic themes abound. Now, the number 9 is not particularly significant in Kabbalah. However, the number 10 is very significant, representing the 10 sfirot, the 10 emanations of God's presence. And once we include the refrain, L'chadodi likrat kala p'nei Shabbat ne'kabbalah, we can see that there are, in fact, 10 components to the poem. Not only are there 10 components mirroring the 10 sfirot, but the interaction between the stanzas also mirrors the interaction that the Kabbalists attributed to the sfirot. The first, second, and 9th stanzas, Shamor v'zachor, Likrat Shabbat, and Bo'i v'shalom, speak about Shabbat directly, either as Shabbat or as a bride. However, the middle 6 stanzas, starting with Mikdash Melech and going all the way to Yamin Usmol, don't really mention Shabbat at all. They're concerned with a different subject, which is the exiled Jerusalem and its redemption. So thematically, the poem moves from 2 stanzas about Shabbat, 6 stanzas about Jerusalem, and then returns to Shabbat. The 3 stanzas about Shabbat may in fact mirror the upper 3 realms of the Sfirah, Keter, Chochmah, and Bina. Whereas the lower 6 Sfirot, running from Chesed all the way down to Yesod, may be mirrored in the stanzas 3 through 8 of the poem. And the last part of the Sfirah tree, Malchut, may either be found in L'chadodi likrat kala p'nei Shabbat ne'kabbalah, in the refrain itself, which weaves its way through the poem, or that refrain may in fact allude to Keter, to the upper realm, which also weaves its way through all the other Sfirot. In short, this poem is structured to mirror some version of the Kabbalistic understanding of God's emanation, the Sfirah tree. One other note about the structure is to notice the words themselves. The number of words and the number of letters are significant to the Kabbalists just as much as the meaning and the allusions of the words. So looking at the refrain, L'chadodi likrat kala p'nei Shabbat ne'kabbalah, from a structure standpoint, we see there are 7 words. That may indicate the 7th day of the week, Shabbat. It may also indicate the 7 lower sfirot. But the significance of this refrain extends beyond the words to the number of letters as well. The number of letters in the refrain is 26. 26 also is the numerical value of God's most holy name, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. But not only that, the Yud-Heh, Yud is 10 and Heh is 5, sums up to 15, which is the same number of letters as the first half of the refrain, L'chadodi likrat kala. And Vav-Heh, Vav is 6 and Heh is 5, summing up to 11, is the numerical value of the numbers in the second half of the stanza, P'nei Shabbat ne'kabbalah. So what you have in this refrain is Yud-Heh, 15, uniting with Vav-Heh, 11. God's name is meant to be united and made whole. When we sing the refrain, we're not only alluding to the meaning of the words, but we're also unifying God's name simply through the recitation of the words and the number of letters that come out in that refrain. So you can see that in order to understand the structure of Lecha Dodi, you have to pay attention to the ways in which the Kabbalists, and specifically Shlomo Halevi Alkabetz, understood the poem as a mirroring of important structural complexes that Kabbalists would see throughout the world generally. If you're interested in more of the ways in which prayers can be seen from a non-meaning or structural standpoint that goes beyond the sense meaning of the words, I invite you to tune into another podcast that I've recorded on our website, mechonadar.org, that is about the aesthetics and non-cognitive aspects of prayer. We're going to move now to looking at the refrain itself and its meaning. As we noted, the number of letters already indicates the way in which we're doing some unification act by reciting Lecha Dodi Likrat Kala. But we're also using the words to indicate some meaning and sense. It's somewhat complex, however. I invite you to look at source number 4 on the source sheet to see how this refrain is taken from a part of Shir HaShirim, a part of the Song of Songs. In chapter 7 of the Song of Songs, verse 12, we read, Lecha Dodi netze hasadeh, nalina bakfarim. Come, my beloved, let us go into the field. Let us lodge among the henna shrubs, or the villages. The word kfarim has multiple understandings. Now, this section of Shir HaShirim is one in which the male beloved, the dod, is being addressed by the female character. It mirrors, in fact, an earlier part of Shir HaShirim, chapter 2, which is source number 5 on your sheet, where we read in verse 10, Ana dodi ve'amarli kumilach rayati yafati ulichilach. My beloved, the dod, the male lover, spoke to me and said, Arise, my darling, my fair one, come away, lichilach. So lichilach is what the male lover says to the female. And now in chapter 7, we see the female lover is addressing the male. And they are meant to go outside to the field. Now, the Kabbalists understood this in some ways literally, moving out to the field, which they saw as a stand-in for Shechina, which is known as the Holy Apple Field in certain Kabbalistic writings, as the place in which the female lover is going out. The word dod and kala appear in this refrain, but we have some other characters worth looking at as well. Shabbat is in the second half of the refrain, which may be the same as the Kala, or may be another character. And a fourth character appears, the speaker of the refrain, the character who is saying, who is addressing the Dod, saying Lecha Dodi. So altogether, in this short seven-word line, we have four characters, the speaker, the Dod, the Kala, the bride, and Shabbat. Now, if one saw this simply as a doubling, the first half and the second half of the refrain being addressed to the same object or the same person, you might have expected it to read this way. Lecha Dodi likrat kala, come, my beloved, to greet the bride, p'nei Shabbat tikabela, go out and greet the presence of Shabbat. But instead we have Nikabela, let us welcome the presence of Shabbat. This indicates the way in which this refrain is moving from a direct address to a let's together go. First I'm speaking to you, and then I'm speaking including myself. This hints at the way in which the characters in the refrain are also a multiplicity of options. Who is the dod? Who is the Kala? Who is Shabbat? And who is the speaker? So one potential option is that the Dod is the Kabbalist himself. And another Kabbalist is addressing Kabbalist number two and saying, go greet your bride. Go greet your wife. Have conjugal relations with your wife on Erev Shabbat in order that you may greet Shabbat. Here, the bride is not associated with Shabbat as the same character, but rather, once the Kabbalist unifies with his wife, with his bride, then together they will greet Shabbat, a third character, probably synonymous with Shekhinah, with God's imminent presence. When man and woman unite in conjugal relations at the beginning of Shabbat, they experience the divine presence. But that's not the only meaning of this refrain. The Dod is also associated with the Sfirah of Tiferet. Lecha Dodi, come Tiferet, to greet your bride, Malchut, Shechina, the lowest part of the Sfirah tree. And together, we will greet Shabbat, which could be associated with Bina, the upper level of the Sfirah tree, the upper Shabbat, the upper female character. And just a note on the method here, in order to understand the Kabbalistic worldview, we may relate to the idea of conjugal relations leading to some experience of the divine presence. We may relate less to the idea of God's emanations themselves uniting in some erotic experience that leads to some unification. But it's important to understand that for the Kabbalists, these two acts were closely connected, that there was very little distinction between the actions on the ground and our real lives and the actions above in the divine realm. Both of them are significant, and both of them mirror each other. So while it may seem a little bit strange and unusual to think of different aspects of God uniting in this erotic fashion, from a Kabbalistic standpoint, it makes a lot of sense to have this as a mirrored connection to the Kabbalist down below. To sum up the refrain, it is an invitation to a multiplicity of actors to do some act of unification. The Dod, either as the Kabbalist or as Tiferet, or both, greeting their respective bride, and then together, everybody, we, will greet Shabbat, whether that Shabbat is Shekhinah, the presence of God that the Kabbalist and his wife perceive or experience, or whether that Shabbat is the upper realm of Bina that's experienced by the lower Sfirot uniting together. Moving on from this refrain, we're going to now look at a number of aspects of the stanzas of the poem. While we're not going to cover the entire poem, we're going to look at some key elements that will hopefully give us some deeper insight into the function and meaning of some of those terms and words. Now, it should be noted that almost all of the phrases in the stanzas are direct quotes from previous literature, almost all of them coming from the Bible and some of them coming from rabbinic literature. That is to say, the poet didn't write new phrases out of his head, but combined and scrambled existing phrases that were known to him from the Bible and from some parts of rabbinic literature. But important to note as well, the Kabbalist who is writing this poem didn't simply re-scramble these words to create a rhyme and spell out his name, but also tried to indicate some Kabbalistic theology in the construction of the poem that's put together through these previously written words and texts. We're going to see time and time again how this is done through some of these words of the stanzas. Let's look at the first stanza, Shamor v'zachor b'dibur echad. Now, this is quoting the section of Torah that talks about the command of Shabbat. The Ten Commandments comes twice in Torah, once in Exodus and once in Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy, we are instructed to shamor et yom ha-shabbat l'kodesho, to preserve or to keep the Sabbath day. And in Exodus, we're commanded to zachor et yom ha-shabbat l'kodesho, to remember the Sabbath day. Chamor and Zachor refer to the two mentions of Shabbat in the two recitations of the Ten Commandments in the Torah. Already the rabbis noticed the similarity and yet difference between these two versions of the Ten Commandments and said, Zachor v'shamor b'dibur echad ne'emru. You can see this in source number 6. I'm taking it here from the Bavli. It's also in the Halachic Midrash and Mechilta. Zachor v'shamor b'dibur echad ne'emru. Zachor, remember, and shamor, keep, were said in one speech act. So notice, the poet here is simply quoting the Talmud. However, there's one change. Instead of saying Zachor v'shamor, we say instead Shamor v'Zachor. What's fascinating, by the way, as a point of contrast, is that one of the other Lichadodi poems that was found in 16th century Tzfat starts off this stanza by saying not Shamor v'Zachor b'dibor echad, but rather Zachor v'Shamor b'dibor echad. So why did Shlomo HaLevi Alkabetz flip the order from Zachor v'Shamor to Shamor v'Zachor? One possibility is that he wanted to spell out his name, which starts with a shin, not a zion. But you could say that there are a number of words that start with a shin that didn't have to alter the order that the rabbis had put this particular phrase in order to start off the poem with the first letter of his name. So why else might he have shifted this? Well, Reuven Kimmelman makes a brilliant, in my opinion, a brilliant suggestion that this is not simply about ordering the letters of his name, but also about indicating a particular Kabbalistic approach to the order of Shabbat. Let's look at the words again and see if we can understand how the Kabbalists understood them in a different way than we might understand them. Start with Zachor. Zachor means remember, but it also is the same root as Zachar, as male. Shamor v'Zachor, there is a male aspect to Shabbat, Zachor, and a concomitant female aspect to Shabbat, Shamor. This is brought out in the Zohar, in the Kabbalistic writings that preceded the Kabbalists at Tzfat. You can see this in source number 7. Shamor hu Shabbat delelia, v'Zachor hu Shabbat yimama. Shamor is the nighttime Shabbat, and Zachor is the daytime Shabbat. At night, we introduce the female aspect. In the day, we introduce the male aspect. But, b'dibur echad, ne'emru. They were said in one speech act. Shamor and Zachor, the female aspect and the male aspect, although distinct, are coming to unite. That's the purpose of this stanza, is uniting the different and disparate aspects of God. Shamor v'Zachor b'dibur echad, the female aspect and the male aspect of God come together as one. Hishmianu el hamyuchad, the unique or the united God, the miyuchad God, yachad, the together God, has caused us to hear. Adonai echad u'shmo echad. Here we also have unity. Why is Adonai echad followed by u'shmo echad? You could have simply said, Adonai u'shmo echad. God and his name are one. Why the repeating of the word echad? So it is a quote from Zechariah, but it's also a way of indicating that Adonai, the upper realms of God's presence, and shmo, shame, the Shechina, the most imminent part of God's presence, all become one. The upper realms unite into one, and then unite with Shechina, forming a final unity. The last part of the stanza, L'shem u'l'tiferet v'litila, also indicates a uniting, even though the word echad is not used here. Let's see if we can figure it out. L'shem u'l'tiferet v'litila is also a re-scrambled quote from the Torah. You can see this in source number 9. Ulititcha elyon al kol hagoyim asher asa litila uleshem ulitifaret. God will set you in fame and renown and glory. Tehila, followed by shame, followed by tiferet. In our poem, we move those words to read instead Shame, followed by Tiferet, followed by Tehillah. Why the moving of the order? Well, if you unlock the Kabbalistic understanding, it may become clear. Tiferet is parallel to the Sphira of Tiferet. Shame, as we saw in the earlier part of the stanza, Ushmo Echad, shame refers to Malchut, to the Shechina, to the immanent part of God. So shame combines with Tiferet and goes up to Tehillah, which is a parallel for Bina, the upper female aspect of God, also known as the upper Shabbat. So just like in the refrain, we said the Dod could be Tiferet and the Kala is Shechina and unites together to greet the upper Shabbat of Bina, here as well, shame is the Shechina, Tiferet is the Dod, and together they unite to the upper Shabbat, known as Tehillah or Bina. Taken together, this first stanza is all about the spherotic uniting of God into one. Let's look at another stanza. Stanza number 3, Mikdash Melech, which I'll note Joey Weisenberg has written a beautiful melody to. Mikdash Melech is already the shift in the theme of the poem as a whole, moving from the theme of Shabbat to the theme of Jerusalem, and more specifically, the redemption of Jerusalem. Now, moving to the last part of this stanza, I want to look at the phrase, V'hu yachamol alayich chemla. V'hu yachamol alayich chemla. He will show compassion or pity to you. This is a rephrased version of the quote from Jeremiah, which you can see in source number 10. Ki mi yachamo alayich Yerushalayim, umi yanud lach, umi yasur lishol leshalom lach. Who will pity you, O Jerusalem? Who will console you? Who will turn aside to inquire about your welfare? In Jeremiah, this pasuk, this verse, is a lament about the destroyed city. And it's a rhetorical question. Who will have pity on you? Who will have compassion on you? Meaning nobody will have compassion on you. But here in our poem, the word me, who, is replaced with the Hebrew word who, meaning he. He will have compassion on you. It's not a rhetorical question anymore. It's a statement. Who yachamol alayich replaces the mi yachamol alayich. Now, the word who has its own meaning itself, which is worth dwelling on for a moment. It's not just a reference to God or to the male aspect of God, he, but rather, it itself is part of the redeemed God doing the redemption. I'll try to explain what we mean. Take a look at source number 11. In source number 11, we read in chapter 17 of Exodus, following the war with Amalek, when Bnei Israel was leaving Egypt, Vayomer, Moses said, Ki yad al kesya milchama l'Adonai ba'Amalek midor dor. The hand upon the throne of God, Adonai will be at war with Amalek throughout the ages. Let's just look at the phrase, Ki yad al kesya. Kesya is a abbreviated form of the word kisei Adonai. The missing letters are the last letter of case is Aleph, Kisei, and the missing letters of God's name are Vav He. When you take Vav He of God's name and the Aleph of Kisei and put it together, you have the word Hu. Now, to our rational ear, that may sound contradictory to any plain sense of the meaning of the verse. But to the Kabbalistic understanding of the verse, it was obvious that the missing aspect of God, the letters He, Vav, and Aleph, are part of the engine of redemption. Only when God is ready to redeem Jerusalem will the full aspect of God be revealed. The Hu, the missing letters that are otherwise hidden, will finally shine forth, and they will be the aspect of God that will have pity on Jerusalem. That is to say, Jerusalem is redeemed when the fullness of God shines in its glory. And the fullness of God can only come together when we unite the various aspects of God through the Kabbalistic understanding. V'hu yachamol alai chemla is a description of how the full and united form of God will enter into the world and redeem the city. Let's move down to stanza number 5. We already noted when looking at the structure of the poem that the number of words is significant. 7 words in the refrain, the number of letters is also significant. Here, I want to note that we have reached the middle of the poem as noted by counting the number of words. The middle of the poem is the phrase, Kiva orech kumi ori, for your light has come, let my light rise up. But counting the words is only one way of discovering that this is an important line, and in fact, the middle of the poem. But the poet himself indicated by a doubling the way in which that phrase is significant. Look at what surrounds the phrase, Kiva orech kumi ori. On the one hand, you have hit-ori, hit-ori, wake up, wake up. And following it, you have uri-uri, awaken, awaken. This doubling, which is itself doubled on each end of the phrase, of the word or ur, is itself a way of signaling that we have reached a significant part of the poem. Let's look at why the middle of the poem is so significant. And I should say, in ancient forms of literature, the middle part of the construction, of the literary construction, was often the most important part of the literary work. So what's so important about the middle of this poem? Well, note on either end, the word or, ayin, vav, resh, which itself is doubled, hit-ori, hit-ori, uri-uri, the word or repeats in the middle phrase, kiva orech kumi ori, with one major change. The letter ayin has shifted to the letter aleph. So whereas you have hit-ori, hit-ori, uri-uri, 4 times, you then move to a collapsing of the 4 onto 2, orech and ori, the collapsing of the ayin into an aleph. Now, what's the significance of moving from an ayin to an aleph? Here we have to note the numerical value of each of these letters. Ayin, numerically, is 70. And 70 is the maximum number, already in rabbinic understanding, of the variety in the world. 70 faces of Torah is meant to be infinite faces of Torah. 70 nations is meant to be a tremendous number of nations. 70 is multiplicity. What's the numerical value of Aleph? 1. What we have here is a moving from a vision of 70, of multiplicity, into a vision of unity, of 1, from Ayin to Aleph. Now, this moving from Ayin to Aleph is not innovated by the Kabbalists, but already appears in an amazing midrash about the story of Adam and Eve. I'm going to direct you to some of our last sources. Source number 13, chapter 3 of Genesis, verse 21. At the end of the sin in the garden, God makes for Adam and his wife kotnot or, garments of or, ayin vavresh, of skin, vayal bishem, and God clothed them. What's amazing is the midrash on this pasuk, on this verse, indicates something unbelievable about a version of the Torah that Rabbi Meir had. Rabbi Meir, who himself was a scribe, the midrash says, Torah Tosha Rabbi Meir, mitzao katuv, in the Torah of Rabbi Meir, it was found written, kotnot or with an aleph, garments of light, not garments of skin or garments of leather. In Rabbi Meir's understanding, in Rabbi Meir's Torah, in fact, God dressed Adam and Eve in garments of light. Now again, the move from ayin to aleph is also a move that we see Kabbalists mirroring in their physical garments. What were they wearing on Erev Shabbat? They were wearing white. They were wearing the color of light. The shed off the skin, the ore with an iron, of their weekday clothing, and revealed the inner light of their being, the ore with an aleph. So what's moving in this stanza is the way in which we can have a journey from multiplicity to unity. That indeed is the theme of the entire poem, but is represented by the letters ayin moving into the letter aleph. One last aspect to note about the middle part of this poem, Kiva Oreich Kumi Ori, when we're talking about the light of God, that itself is a reframed version of a quote from Isaiah. You can see that if you turn back to source number 12. Isaiah writes, Kumi ori kiva orech, uchvod Adonai alayich zarach. Arise, shine, for your light has dawned. The presence of God has shined upon you. Kumi ori kiva orech. Now here again, Shlomo Levi Alkabetz switches the order. Instead of kumi ori kiva orech, it reads, kiva orech kumi ori. Is there a significance to moving orech before ori? So Kimmelman also makes a wonderful suggestion that the typical Kabbalistic understanding of action in the lower realm affecting action in the upper realm is reversed here. Generally, the Kabbalists understand that their actions down below have implications for the actions of the divine sphirot, the ways in which the upper realms are moved. My actions below indicate the ways in which there is some heavenly response, some heavenly mirroring that happens. However, in this reframing, kiva orech, your light comes first, and then my light will come. Here on Shabbat, I'm waiting for your light to make the first move, as it were, for God to take action, and then my light will follow. Shabbat is a time in which the role is reversed, in which the actions below don't lead to actions above, but rather the actions above lead to some actions below. Specifically, the redemptive actions from above leading to the redemption of the city below. So what you have in this stanza is the way in which God is both collapsed from multiplicity to unity, and the way in which, once unified, God is prepared to act and redeem the multiplicity world that we sit in to be a world of unity and oneness, which is consonant with the way in which we might experience Shabbat. So in closing, we see the way in which Lecha Dodi is a poem that has a significant Kabbalistic structure, and also, through the refrain and the stanzas, significant Kabbalistic meaning and allusions that are brought out in the words, which are rescrambled versions of Torah verses and Midrashim in rabbinic literature. I think part of the meaning that's worth dwelling on is the way in which Shabbat itself can be experienced, whether you're a Kabbalist or not, as a moment of considering unity. In what way is Shabbat a time of understanding and experiencing the world as one, as opposed to divided? One last comment on that. We finish Shabbat by making Havdalah, by reciting a liturgical text that is all about distinctions. The main word that repeats over and over again in Havdalah is bein, between, which is the same word that is related to bina, understanding. Bina and Bain is in some ways a weekday activity. In the weekday, you distinguish between things, between light and dark, between holy and profane. But on Shabbat, you are not looking through a lens of Bain. You're not looking through a lens of distinction. You're actually allowed to see the world as one, as unified, both the world as we perceive it and the upper world, the Sefirot of God, that come to unify. Lecha Dodi is an ode to the attempt to view Shabbat as a moment of oneness. And it's my hope that this exploration of the poem Lecha Dodi might add to our own experience of Shabbat as a time of unity and wholeness. For more about Lecha Dodi, I invite you to tune in to the podcast of Dina Weiss, also available at mechonadar.org. And for melodies and tips around davening, I invite you to listen to Joey Weisenberg's rendition of part of Lecha Dodi, also to be found at mechonadar.org. Thank you.